Hello and welcome to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. I am Beth Shank, long-term host of the podcast, with our co-hosts Dr. Heidi Honegger-Rogers and Dr. Heidi Segan, who are interviewing fellows in the Environmental Health Research Institute for Nurse and Clinician Scientists. Today they interview Dr. Shauna Beasy and Dr. Trey DeYoung, discussing population health, analytics, and research. Please read about them in the show notes. Enjoy!
Everyone, and welcome back to our podcast. This is the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. My name is Heidi Segan, and I am joined by my co-host and friend, Heidi Honegger-Rogers. And today we are super excited because we have two awesome guests for you. We will be talking to Dr. Trey DeYoung and Dr. Shauna Beasy from Washington State University. So before we get started, I will ask Shauna first, would you please give us a brief introduction?
Yes, thank you. I'm Shauna, and I'm an assistant professor of rural health promotion through the WSU Extension. I also have an affiliate faculty appointment through the College of Nursing, but I'm primarily county-based, so out in the community doing community-level research.
Fantastic. And Trey, could you also give us a brief introduction?
Of course. Hello, my name is Trey DeYoung. I am an assistant professor at Washington State University at the main Pullman campus. I also serve as the assistant director for CISER, which is basically a research and statistics help lab. So my degree is not in nursing, but my PhD is in applied statistics, essentially, in psychology and education.
Fantastic. Well, you can be an honorary nurse with us today. We're happy to welcome you into our world. So you are doing some amazing, exciting work, and we want to hear all about it. So maybe starting with Trey, can you tell us about some of the current work that you are doing in the environmental health space?
Right. So primarily my work is associated with proper research design and statistical techniques, as well as measurement, which brings me into this health research space. I was working with Shauna on different health outcomes and measures that she's been working on, specifically in the neighborhood health space. And in doing so, we discovered that there aren't necessarily well-established measures of how neighborhoods are impacting health. And so that's kind of what I'm working on, at least in that space, among my other projects, which really have nothing to do with this, but an exciting thing that I'm getting into with Shauna here.
Wonderful. Shauna, well, do you want to give us a little backstory on that work?
Yes, absolutely. Well, as part of my dissertation, which is looking at allostatic load, which is kind of that cumulative stress burden that we have that accumulates over your life course due to chronic activation of your stress response, I looked at that specifically in the neighborhood context. And one of my studies, I did a three-study dissertation, was a grounded theory study looking at how are healthy neighborhoods developed even. So I worked in a prolonged two-year engagement with a intentional neighborhood that was putting themselves together and just looking at, you know, is there some kind of process that we can articulate here that might be transferable in other neighborhood contexts. And so what I found was is that the mechanism of how you build healthy neighborhoods is increasing that level of trust, but all within the context of perceived neighborhood safety. And so since I graduated, I've been eagerly testing that out and seeing how we can develop, you know, usable tools in that space. And so one of the things that I Trey and I have worked pretty closely on is looking at, is there a neighborhood development tool that we could develop that could be brought to the into community spaces to kind of assess where they're at. And right now we've already conducted our exploratory work. We're looking for funding for a confirmatory analysis that we can start looking at rural adaptations of a tool.
Shauna, Trey, that's so amazing. First of all, Trey, I imagine that you're very busy with a degree in statistics. can you come to our university and help me out too? But Shauna, if you guys could talk a little bit more about how neighborhoods, what you're finding, like where the research is and what you're finding in your own research about how the neighborhood, like what are the parameters in the neighborhood that really are promoting health, and how does that interact with the environment and the social and ecological determinants of health?
Yeah. So the highest level of trust that I've found in research is that sense of belonging. So tapping into full connection where your membership within the community is affirmed, you don't have to question it. You even start to blend your own identity with the identity of your place-based location. And so that seems to be a consistent that's holding up in many transferable contexts, whether it be rural or whether it be urban or suburban, even intentional versus just more traditional neighborhoods. So I'm taking that deeper dive and looking at some of those impacts of things like belonging, sense of belonging. And that research has been going back all the way to the 1990s. Of course, Hagerty did a lot of study around sense of belonging in applications for nursing. And turns out, you know, if you have not that sense of belonging, you can have prolonged dysfunction in the HPA axis. So of course, I'm trying to always draw the connection there between that and allostatic load and cumulative stress. So, I mean, it's very early territory. Neighborhood researches, neighborhood effects research isn't new. It came into its own really in like the 2010s, where it became a focus of all public health, but they were using mostly big administrative databases and trying to test out neighborhood effects, you know, at a big macro level. And I think that the next evolution is the work that Trey and I are doing is actually getting into the communities, starting to see what kind of geographic variations occur. Are suburban contexts different than urban contexts? How's that compared to rural contexts? And then finding out not only place-based geographic, like environmental exposures that you can get in your neighborhood, but also what are those protective factors psychosocially that I think would translate across most contexts, but maybe are experienced different.
Shauna, for our non-nurse listeners, would you talk a little bit more about what allostatic load actually is, and then how this, what the HPA axis is, and just sort of like to dive in a little bit more into, you know, what you all are actually looking at and how you're linking that. So that's a two-part question. I'd love to hear how does the research actually work when you're looking at allostatic load and HPA axis. But first, explain it.
Yes. So first, it's a conceptual model. It was developed in the 1990s by a neuroendocrinologist, Dr. Bruce McEwen. And it basically seeks to describe what happens when that fight or flight that's supposed to be, you know, a short-term coping mechanism is activated as a prolonged effect. And so it's that biological response. And what they found is there is a cluster of biomarkers or labs that predict all-cause mortality upwards of even a decade in advance. And Dr. Bruce McEwen and Dr. Teresa Seaman, they put out the initial original 10 biomarkers, but of course then scientists do what scientists do. They exploded and said like, well, wow, if that's all-cause mortality, maybe we can come up with cardio-specific mortality or, you know, things that are attached to cancer. And there were some minor successes there, but what we really have discovered 30 years later is that the base 10 were probably the right biomarkers with the addition of a couple more that have been validated over time. And it really is just that thumbs up, thumbs down, all cause mortality. I can't tell you what you're going to get in 10 or 15 years, but I can tell you your system is absolutely being taxed to the point that there will be systematic level dysfunction at a later date. And of course, we know as nurses that when you when you experience stress, the first thing that gets activated is your HPA axis. And then that coordinates the, you know, the broad concert of the neurotransmitters or neurohormones that are giving that sympathetic stress response. And then eventually your longer immune response. And so that's what they measure. As far as how is that manifesting in our research? Well, first we're wanting to develop that community-based tool. So what we're really focusing on with the funding that we're seeking now is truly that confirmatory factor analysis around the neighborhood tool that's building off the grounded theory study. And then a lot of other secondary data that we've done in like the All of Us database using social determinants of health. But there are a couple other more exploratory things that we are doing. One of the things is that we want to look at the health and retirement survey and see, are there latent class or latent profile analysis that are in their longitudinal data that also look at things like neighborhood disorder, social cohesion, all the things that we study, and how does that relate to allostatic load? Because HRS is one of the health and retirement study is one of the secondary databases that allostatic load researchers use, that and Haynes and the MEDIS have the most robust samples about allostatic load. So we will be doing some exploratory work. And then I honestly look to Trey's guidance on us to turn my ideas into actual sound measurements. So I'm going to kick it to him.
Thank you, Shauna, so much for describing your work and giving a lot of that background. I have to say first, I love this partnership across disciplines. We're seeing that a lot in this environmental health space. And I think the project you're talking about really highlights the importance of that and the expertise that you both bring to this project. So Trey, I have a couple questions for you, but first, can you talk to me a little bit about measurement tool design? Shauna said, you know, she brings the ideas and then you put it all into place. So are there special considerations when you are talking about allostatic load and working in neighborhoods that you think about when you're creating tools and doing that research design?
Oh, absolutely. So obviously I come at these questions not from a nursing perspective, but from a measurement perspective. When you get a survey, you know, someone asking you to be involved in their research, ideally, they've talked to someone like me, not the participant, the researcher has talked to someone like me who is familiar with how you establish the validity of what you're trying to ask your participants. So for example, we're interested in this potential impact of cohesion and safety in a neighborhood. However, before we can establish what that is and how then later on it relates to things like allostatic load, which Sean has described, is we first have to figure out if it exists. And then if it does exist, how exactly do we get at that thing, right? There are many things in the psychological world that we can't directly measure. We can't just pull out a ruler and measure those things. So we have to get at it with these kind of pointed questions. And if you're taking a survey and you feel like, wow, it seems like these questions are all getting at the same underlying thing, that's what we have to establish. It's true. That's exactly what's happening, is we're trying to get at and measure some underlying indirect, what we call a latent construct, that can't be directly measured by asking many related questions. And so some of the groundwork Sean and I have done is Sean has done a grounded theory, which is sort of a qualitative approach where she goes out and interviews people to identify different terms, different themes that are coming directly from the populations we're interested in. And from that, we're able to come up with potential underlying traits we could be interested in. We can write questions using language that our participants have identified for us, so that ideally when we're asking people about something, they'll know exactly what we're talking about because we're using their language. We then use statistical techniques like exploratory factor analysis to see if we can, with numbers, support these underlying constructs as being accurately measured by these targeted questions we ask in our survey. Once we have those, we do something called a confirmatory factor analysis, which is what we're seeking funding for, is gathering another data set where we can kind of confirm that what we found in the exploratory study and the qualitative grounded study is being measured well and in a way that is valid. There's a lot of different theories of what's considered valid, but this is one way that we can use statistics to support that. Once we have well established that we have these underlying factors measured accurately, reliably, in a way that we consider valid and is acceptable among all the researchers in the field, we can then take those things and identify, do these relate to health impacts? So now that we know what neighborhood, trust, cohesion, safety, all those different underlying traits, now that we know what they are, how do they relate to different outcomes for mortality or allostatic load?
Thank you so much for that description of sort of what that process is when you move in to really trying to figure something out and then establish really a new way of doing research around morbidity and mortality from this neighborhood perspective. Shauna, can you talk a little bit about where the literature is currently and what you're building on? Just to kind of explain to people, what do we already know about the impact of neighborhoods on health and well-being?
Well, the literature specifically on allostatic load is, let me give you a little state of the union on where allostatic load is as far as measurement. Right now, it is squarely in the domain of research. So that's unfortunate because there's a lot of people who want to take this, like myself, and get out into the communities and start actualizing and building new knowledge around this, what is clearly a valuable conceptual model. But because it belongs either to the laboratory scientists who came up with the biomarkers or population health people like myself who have, like, you know, made those correlations and associations to all-cause mortality and things of that nature and other potential exposure variables that may increase your likelihood, it has not yet come to fruition. There is a whole nother group of scientists out there that are working on allostatic load right now through clindometrics. So either trying to discover something that a PCP could use in a clinical office, you know, a survey, or maybe an abridged version of the biomarkers, because the biomarkers are at least 10, like I said, the original 10, but two of the original 10 are, you know, epinephrine and norepinephrine as collected by a 24-hour urine sample. So, I mean, as you can imagine, there's not a lot of researchers that are going to be taking that out either clinically or into the community, which is what I'm very interested in. So as a community researcher, I watch and read a lot of the literature and wait for them to develop what comes next. And maybe even as Trey and I get into these more exploratory elements of our collective research, we might even, one of the ideas that we've talked about is using a really comprehensive secondary data analysis with probably all three, HRS, NHANES, and MEDIS. This isn't our, like, what we're going to do tomorrow. This would require more extraordinary funding than we currently have. But is there something that approximates allostatic load? Because all three of those data bases have the gold standards and a longitudinal view of those gold standards of allostatic load measurements. Is there something like CRP, BMI, you know, something that could potentially be collected in a clinical space that could be 70% as good as allostatic load in measurement? So that's some of the things. Now I will let you know, the epigeneticists have entered the field and they have, been like Drs. Morgan and Dr. Horvath, their assertion is, hey, if our epigenetic clocks are strongly associated with allostatic load, which is a well-validated tool, all this, you know, human development people agree on this, it is something that we could do with a cheek swab almost as good too. So I sit and watch and wait for the epigeneticists, of which I am not, to do their magic too. But right now, what community people like myself have at our access is repeated measures like Cohen Perceived Stress Scale, other things. And then that's what I will be bringing out to the community to measure that. So that's what the literature says around allostatic load measure. You know, where we are, State of the Union. So where we are right now with neighborhood health research, like I said, is that we're trying to get it out into the actual specific communities. We've bought off with all the 2010 emphasis that neighborhoods are where we work, live, play, you know. And so the exposure to the environment, the exposure to each other is going to be in greater doses in your neighborhood. And so it's going to have a more longstanding impact, especially when you look at life course. So children, we all know that the environmental exposures to children have longer lasting impacts than say something that happens to me in middle age. And typically children tend to spend the most amount of time in their neighborhoods. And so, looking at that and making the connection to stress is that, you know, how the biomechanism specifically of how allostatic load works. I mean, we think that what it is it's a basic symptom dysfunction due to all the cellular changes that happen when you chronically activate all the things. I think of when you think of diabetes, you know that too many sugary events eventually changes the cell's receptor sites and you are no longer able to receive those chemical messages. Now times that times a million different cellular reactions that happen during your stress response, what we know is that is likely going to be the predecessor to a lot of non-communicable diseases that we see. Those illnesses that turn into chronic disease development, cancer, cardiometabolic disorder, inflammation, all those things probably have a toxic stress beginning. And so to me, that's where the intersection is very exciting, because now we're looking at the biggest place of our environmental exposure and looking specifically, how does that increase increase our risk, and what can we do to protect against those environmental exposures that potentially create stress in our lives?
That's thank you so much for explaining that. It's really just super fascinating. And I know, Shauna, you've been positioned in this place of working with the community, right? Like that's your main job. Can you talk about how your partnership is with the community in working on what the research questions are and sort of explain that process of how you're working in and with the community on this research?
Thank you. So I have to admit, that's probably the most underdeveloped portion of my research, my emerging research program. My PhD training and then my work with people like Trey has really prepared me for using those administrative databases to come up with some broad associations around neighborhood effects. And so I think that needs to continue. There's a lot of rich data out there that's been untapped, especially as you think about people who are triangulating that bigger broad spectrum to actual impacts in the community. But I'm actively seeking. I just finished a course at the University of Washington around implementation science. I've also enrolled in hopefully a cohort that's intended for people who are doing community engaged research. And then of course, as you know, one of my co-faculty members, Dr. Postma, is one of my biggest mentors. And so she's often somebody who's right there alongside me with my research. And she has 10, 15 decades plus history with techniques like photo voice. How do you actually co-create and co-design the research with your community? And so that is the big, that's one of the biggest attractions of the extension program was for me, and why I became a county director is because I wanted to be actually out in the county with people and then receive that training that allows me to move from just observational studies and using statistics into getting out there and making sense of it and with the communities that I'm seeking to study.
Thank you, Shauna. And, you know, I'll build off Heidi's question about bringing communities into the work. And I'm hoping, Trey, maybe you have some insight on this. Like you said, you know, you're working to use language from participants in the design. Can you speak a little bit more to the importance of and ways to engage communities in that very beginning step of the research design? How do you do that? How do you come at that?
Right. So in terms of getting the language from participants and working in the community, in that sense, Shauna probably have a better idea of what all she did in her grounded work to get to the theory that we're currently working on and trying to measure the items. Sometimes we pick items out of convenience. For example, our exploratory factor analysis we conducted was using the NIH All of Us database, which we had no say in how the questions were worded or which items were involved. However, based on what Shauna saw in her grounded research, a lot of the terminology in some of the questions that were chosen was being stated by the participants as she was asking questions about what makes a neighborhood, what makes you feel safe. And so even though these questions weren't directly written by us, we're able to identify, okay, what questions are using a lot of the same verbiage that were discovered by community members. When we collect our own data, of course, which we're seeking funding to do, we'll have a lot more control over the exact things that might have been missed by these questions that we weren't involved in. And so we're able to ask maybe more targeted, specific questions based on the communities we're working with. I know Shauna works a lot with rural communities. My background's in, I grew up on a cattle ranch. So I know, at least from the perspective of these participants, you know, there's this idea of giving back. And I think that tapping into, especially in rural communities, tapping into that idea of giving back is a great way to get engagement in from participants to where you can develop a tool that really accurately reflects the population you're trying to target.
I think Trey's underselling himself because he's actually much more involved than he's indicating. He's not just doing the statistics portion or the research design, which he absolutely is doing that. He was one of my first mentors in that space, dovetailing off of my PhD training. But he's a full partner in this research at this point. And Dr. Postma, when she comes in, comes alongside these grants, she's not just coming alongside me. She's going to be also engaging with Trey and also his psychological background. I think we might be understating that, because the way he sees how, like, oh, well, this is how the psychosocial factors might tie into the geographic context or might manifest these neighborhood effects. Those are all the discussions we have, all the way down to the grounded study. I'm already doing follow-up research in grounded theory in the rural context. So now we're interviewing all new groups of people, rurally based people. And he has insight into that analysis as well. So I just don't want to make it seem like all he's doing is helping me with the exploratory factor analysis and all we talk about is canonical correlations or anything.
Well, all of that sounds very important to me, both aspects of the work that Trey's doing. And Trey, when you mentioned your background of growing up on a cattle ranch, that... I have a question for both of you, and I guess we can start with Trey. So what got you involved in this work? Why is this exciting to you? Tell us your story. How did you end up here talking to us today?
Right. So as I said, I grew up on a cattle ranch. I learned things like problem solving, for example. There's a lot of problem solving. And surprisingly, there's a lot that goes into cattle ranching. You have to be skilled in a lot of different areas to find success. And although I didn't end up being a cattle rancher, some of that You know, it's funny, I'm talking to nurses. Some of the medical side, per se, or the veterinary side of that is really what scared me away from continuing along that path. But the drive for this problem solving pushed me into, well, maybe I should do engineering. Started into that, realizing, oh, maybe I don't want to be an engineer for the rest of my life. Kudos to those individuals. So I switched into the realm of psychology. People have always interested me. And within psychology, I found statistics and measurement and those sorts of things, which eventually led me to my PhD program at the University of North Texas down in the Dallas area, where my degree was educational psychology with an emphasis in research, measurement, and statistics, essentially giving me a big old toolkit to solve problems and research, essentially. And so from that point, interacting with researchers such as Shauna here at Washington State University, I've been able to dip back into those roots of rurality and, you know, understanding a more agricultural mindset. There's obviously way more agricultural research at Washington State University, especially at the Pullman campus, than there is in Dallas, Texas, contrary to what people may view Texas as being like. And in doing so, it sort of reminded me and reawakened my interest in studying rural individuals. You know, what is it that makes a rural person? And from my personal experience, as well as what Shauna and I are observing in the current research, it seems to be closely tied to what their neighborhood is like. You know, how do you define a neighborhood, and what supports people have in their community?
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that seed story. It's really fascinating and an amazing, again, like I said before, such an amazing skill set. Shauna, I've had an opportunity to listen to some of your seed stories, but for the recording, would you tell us about how you got interested in the work that you're doing currently and how you became an environmental health nurse?
So I came an became an environmental health nurse only secondary to that. My primary interest was always neighborhoods. I was adopted and I am lifelong citizen of the same neighborhood my entire life. And I've often thought how lucky I have been not only to find a family, you know, that adopted me, but also that I got to grow up in that specific neighborhood and how important neighborhoods are on every aspect of who we become across our life course. As Heidi knows, I'm a city councilwoman of my little small town. So it's only, you know, 2,000 people, 708 households. Through that experience as being a city councilwoman, I have discovered everything environmental is actually originating from your neighborhood. So whether you have clean water or not, when you turn on that faucet, guess what? That's your city council that's deciding those rules. Property use code is largely dictated by your city council or your small neighborhood councils, and all those things, not only into the social connectivity piece that we spoke about earlier, that sense of belonging, that psychosocial adjustment, but there's very real environmental impacts that are absolutely being determined by you and your neighbors collectively. And so when I came to the PhD program, I pretty much knew I was going to study neighborhoods. I only later through education found out, oh, that's called environmental health. Oh, I'm a population health scientist. So it really was just as simple as I knew my neighborhood was just as important to me as my family of origin. And so I wanted to study that relationship.
Thank you for both of you for sharing your stories. I always love hearing how we get to where we are, because there's typically some sort of a winding path to get there. So I appreciate you both sharing. Shauna, I'm interested to hear from you. You know, you talked a little bit about your city council work. And so There is definitely a place for policy when it comes to environmental health nursing. So I'd love to hear you speak a little bit about that and really your ideas for how nurses can get involved in that sort of work.
Absolutely. And I actually think this is one of the strengths of Trey and myself as a research partnership is that we both definitely look at the world through the socio-ecological tier, but we think the most important layer is probably stopping at that community level. So I tend to focus a lot on that local level advocacy and just being aware that so much of your existence is being driven at that local level. But guess what? Good news. You get to have the most impact at that level. If you show up at a city council meeting, guess what? They care what you have to say. So it's not like a big targeted letter writing campaign that I usually engage nurses in. I say, are you familiar with the neighborhoods? When I moved to Bellingham, which is where I work, one of the first things I did was look at, well, what's their neighborhood grid? How do they define their neighborhoods? Are there neighborhood councils within the city council, you know, domain? Because often bigger metropolitan areas will have neighborhood councils that feed up and advise the city council. So these are places that nurses should be at and have full knowledge on if they want to create that environmental impact. I, of course, support everything that Annie does. And I think that advocacy needs to ascend to the federal levels and at all board, you know, boards, rooms everywhere. But for me personally, I try to focus on that local level and what can you do to make that impact? Because sometimes it can just take a handful of people from the local church to create widespread change. One of the stories I share often is I got turned into the city that I ended up being a city council person for because I had too many chickens. I was very passionate around food policy. And perhaps I got a little aggressive in my attempts to relocalize our food economy, and I got turned into the city. And so what do I do? Do I get rid of all the chickens, or do I convince neighbors that if me and my husband come over to your house and take care of the chickens, would you be willing to take four? Because that's what our city allows us to have. So there was a while that we had chickens all over the neighborhood. And what we think we did over the next 10 years is we really normalized some of these backyard homesteading activities about gardens and chickens. And then there was bunnies and there was all other kinds of aspects of food, to the point that neighbors that we had potentially been turned into were the ones that went to the city council 7 years later and asked for us to relook at our land use codes to see if we could lighten up and perhaps even incorporate goats or incorporate other aspects of homesteading into our local economy. Because we can't replace our food, but if you can provide you and your neighborhood 10, 15% of the food that's being shared at the tables in your neighborhood, that's a resilience level that just other areas don't have.
Shauna, that's amazing. I love that story. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. And Trey, you know, as we're talking about the future and policy and movement building and action, can you talk a little bit about how you see your role as a researcher, as a faculty member in this area of potentially policy and practice?
Right. So I don't think it comes as a shock to anyone that the best policy is probably research driven. So I think a lot of our role and what our research is doing is, first, we're trying to develop tools that don't currently exist or exist in a very flimsy It has a very flimsy existence. It's not very well established. And so first, I think by establishing tools for researchers, we're able to sort of greatly expand what all can be built in this research area. And from that point, once these tools are established, we view our research as contributing in, of course, seeing, do these things relate to allostatic load? Once we have these measures, we can see, do clusters exist or what we'd call latent profiles or latent classes of individuals that maybe view neighborhoods in one way or another way, and then seeing if, having identified maybe there are certain types of neighborhoods or certain types of people, how does health, allostatic load impact their health? How does allostatic loads impact someone else's health? We'd love for these measures to be specific to different types of communities, right? We mentioned rural communities. Well, as we write in our proposal, I like this word Shawna used, that rural communities are not a monolith, right? They're not all the same. And so a lot of my interest in the statistical realm is statistics that look at the context of different relationships and effects. And I think by developing more and more contextualized tools and establishing within context what works for this group, what works for that group, that's really where I think our research direction is going and how we as a research group will be able to contribute to society and probably by means of telling people our research policy coming from those things and working with, like Shawna said, more localized policy builders because our research should be specific enough where people can know, okay, for my community, the evidence shows that this works, or for my community, the evidence shows that this works in this community.
Perfect, Trey. I was just going to ask you, because one of the strengths I think Trey has really brought in to our research team is saying, you know, there's a truth, but there's a truth within a context. And so he uses statistics to really explore and tease out some of that context. And I don't think that that's been there.
So one example of an analysis that can be conducted once we've established our tools that we've been talking about this whole time is it goes by many names. One is hierarchical linear modeling, multi-level modeling, mixed effects modeling, random effects modeling, all the same basic concept. And the idea is that data or things we're measuring exist in a nested structure. So in like hospitals, for example, you might have patients is what you're interested in measuring, right? What are their different outcomes, their health outcomes, mortality, things like that. Those patients exist under healthcare providers. Those patients exist in certain hospital systems. They exist in certain communities with certain policies related to health, or states with certain health policies. And the idea is that we cannot look at what happens to a patient without considering the context, the kind of nested data structure around these numbers we're getting about a patient, which represent, you know, how they're doing health-wise. And so measuring something about a neighborhood, for example, we view the neighborhood as being directly, intimately impacting people. And in for the purposes of this podcast, you know, in terms of impacting their health. And so these multi-level or hierarchical models allow us to consider characteristics about a patient, and then it allows us to consider characteristics about maybe their neighborhood. So we can use these measures about how cohesive is the neighborhood, how many crimes are existing in this neighborhood, what sort of policies are in this neighborhood for collaboration, are there events in this neighborhood that would make individuals trust each other more. And we can see not only what happens to patients, but how these higher tier effects of neighborhood may also be impacting patients. So that's one example of what I call contextualized statistics.
Oh my gosh, you all, fantastic. I just want to appreciate the work that you're doing and that you're actually working on building out a toolkit that I'm hopeful all of us are going to be able to start using in a way of how we move out and work with communities to improve neighborhood health and human health and well-being and flourishing in the context there. I just want to appreciate on behalf of myself and my colleague Heidi, Trey DeYoung, Shauna Beezy, thank you for being you. Thank you for being the people who are doing this work, who are leading this kind of work for the rest of us. And we look forward to seeing how this turns out and how we can take what you're doing and adapt it in all of our different areas and nooks and crannies of nursing and public health and healthy environment nursing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here and talk to you. A lot of fun stuff.
Thank you to Drs. Beezy and DeYoung. This is exciting work to understand complex relationships between different variables that impact health, and to do so using strong analytic tools while maintaining fidelity to the context of neighborhoods and lived experiences. Thank you to Dr. Honegger Rogers and Dr. Segan for a wonderful interview. And thank you all for listening. And as a reminder, the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast is 100% non-commercial. We charge nothing and advertise nothing. Please help us spread the word by telling your nursing colleagues, families, and friends. Thank you. Talk to you next time.